Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for community, life sciences, and workplace clients, on the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. When you listen to the president address the nation, do you hope to hear plain talk or soaring oratory? Should it be dignified or down to earth? That question led Alan Metcalf to look into the speaking styles of our presidents from the 1st to the 43rd. Alan Metcalf is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of several books on language. His latest is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. The book is divided into two parts. The first half of the book offers a discussion of presidential styles. Here you'll also find a chapter on how the president's Hollywood has created speak. The second half of Presidential Voices offers profiles of our presidents to date and their speaking styles. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest, Alan Metcalf. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Alan Metcalf is a professor of English at McMurray College and executive secretary of the American Dialect Society. His previous books on language include How We Talk, American Regional English Today, Predicting New Words, The Secrets of Their Success, America in So Many Words, and The World in So Many Words. His new book, Presidential Voices, is published by Houghton Mifflin. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Metcalf, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure.
One of the chapters in your new book is titled How to Talk Like a President, and you tackle that question, you know, what do we want, plain talk or something that soars, something that inspires? Of our presidents to date, have many been able to do both?
Not too many. I would say that in the 20th century or 21st, the one who did best at that was President Franklin Roosevelt, although he was down-to-earth and plain-spoken in just a relative sense because he was rather an aristocratic New Yorker. And being really down-to-earth is a challenge for most presidents. On the other hand, for the current president, being down-to-earth is not a challenge.
Yeah, it seems he's most comfortable being down-to-earth.
He is, and in fact, it seems to me that the speeches that his speechwriters prepare for him, which are excellent speeches, are ones that don't really seem to be his style. You don't picture him in his conversation talking in that way.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that the Republican convention will put the president on a stage this evening that the GOP hopes will feel more intimate and more comfortable for the president. It's being described as a theater in the round setting. What do you think?
Well, you know, there's the, starting with the invention of the phonograph, the style of speaking had to adjust to the, from the old-fashioned oratory where you would speak loudly to a large audience to the more intimate audience of, well, first the phonograph, then the radio, and then television, where you're really speaking to someone in their own living room. Franklin Roosevelt got that properly at first with his fireside chats, where he'd be talking as if he were talking to someone in their own living room. And even last night, there was a nice contrast between Dick Cheney, who spoke as if to one person, and that fine Georgia senator who spoke to the crowd. And I suppose what they're aiming to do for George W. Bush, I didn't know about this setup, but I suppose the aim is to make it seem more intimate so that those who watch on television or listen on the radio can think that, well, he's just talking to me.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, what did you think? Did you see Zell Miller's speech last night?
I was very impressed with it. It was something of an old-fashioned speech, but the thing that matters most with speeches nowadays is not the development of a thesis or the carefully laid out plan of speaking that is characteristic of the oratorical style, but rather it's the sound bites, because on the radio and television nowadays, you're not going to hear the full speech repeated. You're going to want a sound bite. And there were a few pretty strong sound bites, it seems to me, from his speech last night.
Yeah. Well, his speech was, it did strike me as, and I heard only parts of it later, and I tried watching it today on the internet, and it's not quite you don't quite get the same feel. But you're right, it had that more of an old-fashioned, almost a yell kind of a speech, which you can hear in recordings of past political speakers from way back, from the early days of recording. And then Dick Cheney comes along, and he's a very different kind of speaker, although his speech was just sort of, it got the job done, I suppose, but it was much calmer.
Yes, and it seems to me that if you were listening to both of them, you might get scared by Zell, but you'd be more likely to think, well, Dick Cheney is speaking in a calm, ordinary way. He's saying sensible things. I'm more likely to believe him than I am to believe Zell, although I might be frightened out of my wits by what Zell was saying.
Mm. And the word is that tonight President Bush will do the vision thing.
Yes. I've been reading a few things about his speech tonight, and I heard some just now on your NPR. It sounds like it's going to try to be a catch-all that has everything and will probably end up not being as memorable as everybody wants. It's the kind of speech where you get all the best speech writers putting in all their best ideas. It's apparently going to have something of a shopping list, not as bad as a State of the Union address, but this, that, and the other things. And here's something that I'm going to watch for. When George W. Bush has a speech prepared for him, sometimes it seems to me he's not that thrilled to be giving the speech. He'd rather be on his ranch. And when he does that, he sometimes pauses in strange places as he is reading it, but not paying much attention to it. So I'm going to be very interested to see whether George W. Bush is engaged enough to be focused on his words and will be saying them as if he really means them.
Yeah. It seems also in prepared speeches for the president, he's more likely to trip. I mean, he might mangle the language in off-the-cuff conversation, but he's more likely to really fall down in prepared speeches.
That could be, although he's a pretty good reader of prepared speeches, I think. His special trippings come when he is set free and rambles around and starts a sentence and ends up somewhere else and takes a word that's a familiar word and twists it around a bit. When he has a speech to read, it seems to me he's kind of like maybe a C-plus student in a speech class who's carefully had the stuff written out and dutifully reads it and has practiced enough so that he follows along.
Yeah, it was interesting to read in your book, Presidential Voices, that you think the president's difficulties stem from his education.
Well, I think that what he's doing is, if he had just stayed in West Texas, which is an impossibility in the Bush family, but if he had just stayed in West Texas, if he just stayed in Midland, if he had kept to the down-home shucks style, then he wouldn't make up all these big words that he does, words like, misunderestimate women of cover. That's a rather ingenious one, by the way. Embetterment, subliminable, mensual, punditry. Those are words. He wouldn't even know pundit, if he hadn't gone to Yale and gotten a bit of an education. But what it shows is that he really doesn't care if he trips up in his language, And in fact, I gave the last part of the last chapter of my book over to him. I was pointing out all of his mistakes, but pointing out that he himself, early in his presidency, went to a Texas reading conference and read aloud from the book of Bushisms and laughed at them as much as anybody else.
Yeah, I think he's worked to turn his difficulties with language into a plus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There is a chapter in the book on speechwriters. Speaking of speechwriters, and you pose a question at the outset of this chapter. The speeches of our presidents, their speeches, their remarks, even their jokes and quips, haven't they been scripted by speechwriters? When did speechwriters begin to assist presidents?
Well, this is one of the amazing things that I discovered as I was looking into the material for this book. George Washington was the first of the presidents to have speechwriters. His very famous farewell address was written by, well, you could say a committee, or rather written by one person and then rewritten by another. Now and then Washington would poke his head in and say, actually, I'd like you to say this or that. And he certainly adopted it as his statement at the end. But presidential speechwriters, well, none of them would have ever been considered to be called a speechwriter. One of them was John Adams, another was Hamilton, but that title is new, but helping the president prepare important remarks has always been something of a committee activity. It's rare that a president prepares important remarks entirely on his own.
Hmm. But there have been presidents, by and large, who've penned their own speeches?
Well, during the 19th century, even though there was the exception of Washington, by and large, presidents tended to write their own remarks. And even in the early 20th, it gets to, around the time of Roosevelt, around the mid-20th century, that beyond that point, presidents, maybe they were so busy, maybe they just had larger staffs, tended to have fewer and fewer things written by themselves. But, you know, one of them who was said to be his own best speechwriter was Ronald Reagan. He came up with something that was called the speech long before he even became governor of California. He went around giving this speech, and he developed it carefully. He tried out different bits on audiences. He worked out his own philosophy, and as an actor, he perfected it. I don't mean he gave that same speech throughout his presidency, but he was one who paid very close attention to exactly how he would say something.
Hmm. And his skill as an actor, or his background as an actor, I'm sure some people would argue with my use of the word skill, but his background as an actor certainly helped him on stage as a giver of speeches.
Yes, and I think on stage is a good way to say it. He was a trained actor. He wasn't an Academy Award-winning actor,
right. But
he was a trained actor who knew, as an actor does, the importance of delivery. And so even his gestures, his facial expression, his tone of voice, he could say an anecdote 40 times over and say it with just the right inflection that he had developed, testing it against audiences as he went along.
Yeah. And it seems to me that also he was skilled at timing and also at gesturing, you know, the turn of the head.
Yes.
Almost winking at us, kind of those kind of mannerisms.
Yes, indeed. And he was the ultimate Hollywood president, one who really presented himself like a president. In my chapter on presidents in the movies and television, I think I end up with him as the example, someone who is the kind of president who presents himself, who appears before the public, the way we think a president should.
Hmm. Of the presidents that have been fictional presidents on television and in the movies and on stage, who are your favorites?
Well, on television, I do like Martin Sheen of The West Wing. He's such a magnificent president, and he has, in terms of speaking, which is what my book is mainly about, we generally want our presidents to be excellent speakers. It turns out that you don't have to be an excellent speaker to be president, and many presidents aren't. But when you get to movies or television, we are happy to have television and movie speakers, presidents who are exceptionally good speakers, and the President Bartlett on the West Wing is just one example of that. And then you think of almost any president in any other movie. We have movies like Dave, and movie which is just a little comedy, but the president is a very good speaker. We have I can't even think of them now, but people who have portrayed Lincoln, people who have portrayed Kennedy, people who have portrayed Truman, they're at least as good speakers as the original presidents, and sometimes better.
Hmm. So who gets your vote for greatest presidential orator?
I think that there's no question that the greatest orator is John Adams, or was John Adams. Now, this is the era of oratory. I really say that there's oratory until the days of mechanical aids to speaking, after which it's the era more of sound bites. But up to about 1900, well, I guess there could be a question of whether Lincoln was a better orator. I'd say only that if you read Lincoln's first inaugural address, it's pretty tedious and painful. He was capable of some pretty awful ones, whereas John Adams was a renowned speaker as a lawyer. I think his first inaugural address, where he had George Washington standing behind him and yet was able to come out making a good case for himself being president, where he gave one of the sentences in that speech is 727 words long, the longest sentence in any inaugural address, and yet he kept his audience captivated and he got strong applause.
How do you get through a sentence like that?
Well, it has parts to it. It's a long sentence with if you think so-and-so, if you think something else, if you think so-and-so, and going on for, and so what you're waiting for then, he even builds up a kind of suspense because the ifs mean, all right, well, if this, then, and he goes on and on and on finally. But he says, if, for example, a respectful attention to the constitutions of the individual states and a constant caution and delicacy toward the state governments, if an equal and impartial regard to the rights, and so on, so on, so on, so, takes up three pages in my book. If so and so and so and so, then it shall be my strenuous endeavor that this sagacious injunction of the two houses shall not be without effect. I guess you have to read the whole thing and take it slowly to get the proper effect. When I first saw that, I thought this is the worst speech ever. but the more I read it, the more I thought he knows his audience, he's holding them in suspense, and then he lets them loose by saying, you've done wisely in choosing me.
Hmm. You know, listening to you describe this, it reminds me of a litany and
yes,
and a style of preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where some of our best African-American speakers, they will grab hold of you like that.
Yes, indeed. I think Barack Obama at the Democratic Convention, for example, did a good job of that sort of thing, and he's not even a licensed preacher.
Hmm. Yeah, I missed Al Sharpton's speech, but I heard it was something.
I missed that, too.
Yeah, yeah. The speeches presidents made early in our history, they're recorded, you know, they're recorded on paper. Are there many accounts of how those speeches that we cannot hear today but only read were received?
Yes, fortunately there are, and one of the reasons I wrote about the presidents was that I thought if anybody's had some audience descriptions of how they sounded in the days before recordings, it would be the presidents. So we have people, for example, reacting to Lincoln. In fact, there's even a small book about how Lincoln spoke and what his way of speaking sounded like. He had apparently a very high, shrill voice that nobody described as particularly pleasant, but it was very useful in those days before amplification, because a high, shrill voice, at least his high, shrill voice, was able to reach to the outer fringes of an audience of 20,000. And we also know, as for John Adams, perhaps his most important speech was one that he gave to the Constitutional Convention just before adopting the Declaration of Independence. and his speech was in favor of adopting it, and it was such a powerful speech that it apparently carried the day. It was the turning point. People like Jefferson and many others said they were just overwhelmed by it. They were so overwhelmed that none of them wrote down what he'd said, not even Adams later, but they all agreed that it was just a dazzling, overwhelming speech.
Hmm. President Lincoln's Cooper Union speech was recently reenacted by the actor Sam Waterston. What do you think of that speech, and how do you think, what do you think in general of these reenactments of speeches?
Well, in general, one thing I've noticed is that the reenactors usually don't try to imitate the original accent of the speaker. As long as they give the speech, they consider that in a proper emphasis and so on, they consider that appropriate. Sam Waterston, I think, for example, has a lower pitched voice than Lincoln, and I don't think he makes any effort to raise the pitch of his voice. Now, the Cooper Union speech is an example of the old-fashioned kind of oratory where Lincoln wasn't just giving sound bites. He had a patient audience, as they did in those days, and he outlined the case and made his case and gave all kinds of references, and apparently he'd done a lot of research before giving that speech. And it was very effective. It persuaded his audience. It was one of the turning points in getting him to the nomination and election for the presidency. It was a quite different thing than nowadays.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Alan Metcalf. He's professor of English at McMurry College and executive secretary of the American Dialect Society. He's the author of several books on language. His latest is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the surprises of Presidential Voices was that there's been more than a few who were not very good speakers who didn't care for it. And that really surprised me about Thomas Jefferson. Tell us about him.
Yes, Jefferson's problem, or one of his problems, was that he had a weak voice and thus couldn't be heard very easily. Another problem, perhaps, was that he was a gentleman and he didn't feel like taking part in debate. So during the debate about the Declaration of Independence, even though he'd written it, he didn't say a word, and he just didn't like speaking in front of large assemblies. In fact, so he was the one who changed the custom of delivering the State of the Union address. Washington and Adams had presented it in person to the Congress. Jefferson sent it in writing, and it wasn't until Woodrow Wilson, more than a century later, that the custom of saying it in person to Congress was resumed. And it was said also, though, there's quite a bit of commentary about Jefferson in private, at a dinner party or in conversation or in small conversation. He was a brilliant conversationalist. He was exceptionally good as a host in drawing out his listeners so that he wasn't pontificating, but letting them feel that they'd had something to say. And he was really wonderful in private. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to be in private with him.
Mm. And I've got a couple of listeners who are joining us now on the telephone, but before we go to them, I do want to get your thoughts about George Washington. What kind of speechmaker was the first president?
Well, he was exceedingly important as setting the model for the presidency, which he was very conscious of doing. And he believed that the American president, a mere citizen, needed to be the equal of the crowned heads of Europe, to show that an enlightened, educated person didn't need royalty or ancestry. So Washington made a point of being very dignified and formal in his speeches, and that's a model that he set that every president since has had to follow, or at least had to look over his shoulder at it. And if the president doesn't, then the president's speechwriters will be looking over their shoulder. You've got to be dignified, as well as down to earth.
Mm. Let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to talk with a listener in Champaign County on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have 3 points, and then I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
State of the Union address is the big speech of the year, and for the longest time, I guess, and maybe I was going to ask you to review that, because it was always just a letter sent for quite a few years, just something on that and how that evolved over time, and something on Reagan that we always hear that he was sort of an actor, but what people don't comment on was that he, for the longest time, he was a spokesperson for GE, and he actually wrote the speech while he was, you know, being sort of kept by this corporation. I mean, I think they put him up in an all-electric house in San Fernando Valley or somewhere. So he was sort of working for the corporations at a very early time. I mean, not just Borax. But and the other thing about Bush is, did you happen to survey... in your survey, I assume you read around. Are you familiar with Mark Crispin Miller's book called The Bush Dyslexicon, where he sort of talks about the fact that he's not good with a prepared speech, he's not good extemporizing at a press conference, which is we don't have so many of them, but he seems to have the most clarity when he's actually speaking, as one might sort of expect, sort of from deep belief. But since he's handlers sort of don't want him to be radically conservative, radically reactionary as that in public as much as he has to put on this false face. Now, obviously, that's a ideologically loaded question. I don't know how you'll handle it, but if you would say something about those things, I will listen, and I must be on my way. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, those are three good things to talk about. The State of the Union thing was the one I just mentioned, that because of Jefferson's shyness or maybe reticence, for a century or so, it wasn't presented in person by the president. But there was the precedent that George Washington had done it, as well as Adams. And if George Washington did it, you can do it too. And so Woodrow Wilson resumed that practice, and no president since has been able to stay away from that great opportunity, although those are often very tedious addresses. As for Reagan being an actor and giving his speeches before he became a politician, that's certainly true. He really developed his own beliefs and wrote his own script. And not only that, but he rehearsed it and practiced it and refined it. So yes, he was an actor, and he did give speeches of others, or written by others, by his speechwriters, people like Peggy Noonan. But he himself contributed a great deal to them. And as for Bush, yes, I've come across the Bush dyslexicon. There's a great temptation when people don't speak in a standard way or fluently to get very psychological about it, or to figure out, well, this must be an indication of this or that. And I'll leave the depth psychology to somebody else. I will just say, though, that by his speech, by his way of speaking, he is indicating consciously or unconsciously that he's down to earth, that he's not one of these highfalutin intellectuals, that he is comfortable with his own way of speaking. And it could be, when you think about it, if you go to a store and everybody in the store is very well dressed and impeccably speaking well and so on, you might feel intimidated. You go to another store and there's this guy who stumbles over his words, and you feel very comfortable with him. You know that, well, I can't do any worse. In fact, it reminds me, when singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at the Cubs games, the person who started it was Harry Carey, and supposedly Bill Veeck got him to do that because Veeck said, nobody can sing worse than you, so everybody will sing along with you.
Interesting. Let's talk with another listener on a cell phone on line four. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. I just appreciate your show, and I've often wondered about the Douglas and Lincoln debates, and it's my understanding that there may have been sometimes as many as 10,000 people at those debates, and in addition to being quite a social event, I just can't imagine, before any kind of amplification, how anybody beyond the first maybe 10 or 12 rows, and I suspect people stood rather than sat for those things, were able to hear much of anything. Can you add some ideas to that?
Well, I think that goes back to Lincoln having a high-pitched, very far-carrying voice that quite a few people remarked about. I think that at Gettysburg there were 20,000, and supposedly even at the far corners of the crowd, he could be heard. So I'm sure he developed that voice, and having a high pitch was helpful. I don't know about Douglas's voice, but he obviously must have developed his voice, too. The people certainly stood so that they wouldn't be so far apart. And in those days before television, before the Internet, before movies, before phonographs, that was one of the great kinds of entertainment.
Just imagine, though, speaking like that to a crowd at the Assembly Hall, and I can't imagine, even in a space like that, that you could, that a person's voice could carry that well.
Well, you might also think of opera singers who are, at least in the pre-microphone days, who are able to convey their voices. I think it takes training. Now, Lincoln obviously didn't have training, but at least he had practice. And if you develop your voice, it's amazing what you can do, I think.
Sure. Hey, thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Alan Metcalf, author of Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. Back to our first caller and the evolution of the State of the Union Address. Maybe you'd like to talk with us about President Reagan and his Heroes in the Balcony.
Yes. Reagan was the first to introduce the Heroes in the Balcony, where at the State of the Union Address at a certain point, he would refer to and point out someone in the balcony sitting with the honored guests, someone who had been an ordinary hero or maybe a special, done something special. It was Reagan's attempt, and it shows what an actor and a theatrical person he was, his attempt to take this long laundry list of working on this and working on that, which is what the State of the Union Address generally has been for the past couple of centuries, and put a little liveliness and character into it. The very first one was the man who had rescued some people from the crash of the airplane that crashed into the Potomac River and a few weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was dramatic. I still remember the footage of that rescue when this man was pulling people out of the water. Now, since then, has the Hero in the Balcony been a feature of the State of the Union speech?
Well, of quite a few of them. Not every one of them, but
Clinton did it.
I think this year, didn't they have, it maybe wasn't a hero, but people like leaders of various countries or people, I can't even remember very recently.
Yeah, I think maybe this past time there were people in the service.
That's right, right, sure.
Yeah. And I know Carter did it. I don't know if 41 did it, the current president's father.
I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
Some of them, well, for example, just, George W. Bush talked about the current president of the Iraqi Governing Council. Sir, America stands with you and the Iraqi people as you build a free and peaceful nation. Mm-hmm. So, It's now something that the writers of the State of the Union speech think of as they are putting the speech together.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Charleston, line 4, the toll-free line. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about what has happened now that we, and especially watching speeches on TV, we very often have a very clear, almost a too close-up view of the speaker. And what's the nature of the interaction between the facial expressions of the speaker and what he or she is actually saying?
You know, that's a very good point, because, and it's a problem, I suppose, for almost anyone with a large live audience and also a television audience. Television has gone more and more to real close-ups, which are appropriate if you are in a studio with just a few people and are talking to people in their living rooms. But if you've also got the big audience out there, then you either have too much makeup or too little, just to talk about the makeup, let alone the expressions that you use. I'm not sure that there's any perfect solution there, but the people who stage it need... Oh, I know what they do. They project the speaker on a huge television screen in the arena. So that means the speaker can then look more and talk more as if the speaker were talking to somebody's home television set. I think that's the solution that the programmers have come up with.
Well, it seems to me, in I guess it comes to mind the concept of the fireside chat.
Yes.
Which works well, it seems to me, or trying to personalize the communication, when you do not see the speaker. But it seems to me that it's very difficult, no matter how the speaker says whatever he or she says, to bring about that same impression of, well, the speaker is speaking to me.
Yeah.
When they're seen the way they are commonly seen in a TV presentation.
Yes, indeed. And Celeste, was there something about tonight's speech going to be given in from some kind of a more intimate setting?
Right, the Theater in the Round setting. They're rebuilding the stage for the president.
So I suppose it could look as if he's just chatting with a few friends, and then they would project that in a big screen above the audience. But it's clear that the people who do television presentations are aware of this kind of a problem, whether there's a good solution except for just turning off your TV and listening only to the radio, which is a
good idea.
I would advocate that.
Everybody listen to WILL.
Right.
Hey, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, this reminds me of recent presidential debates when we've gotten away from the lectern, and there are like director's chairs, and it's in a more casual kind of feeling to it, and the speaker might get up and walk toward the audience with the microphone either clipped to them or in hand.
Yes, and there's another thing that's a mixed genre, because debates are basically an old-fashioned kind of way of having things. I mean, after all, the Lincoln-Douglas debates are very famous in that regard. There weren't any presidential debates until Kennedy and Nixon in the 60s, or I guess in 1960. And the problem is, if you think debate, and there's a problem that John Kerry has. He was a champion debater at Yale, but debate done college style is kind of like wrestling done college style. It's a little different from the professional type. It's not as showy and more old-fashioned. And the problem with the debates that we have is, again, it's not as if they're really arguing reasoned points, trying to make a case. What they're trying to do is show off their personality and maybe get across a few really good sound bites, and then tripping up the opposition. Reagan was really good at that, saying, well, there you go again.
Mm.
And all of the careful argument on the other side was blasted away by just that casual remark.
Yeah. Do you think, John Kerry, would it be fair to say that he has almost two speaking styles? One in a formal setting and one in a less formal setting?
I suppose so, though his less formal setting is quite a bit more formal than George W. Bush's.
Sure is.
And one of the interesting things also is that John Kerry used to have a rather strong Massachusetts accent. If you listen to or watch the videotapes from his Vietnam protest era, he has a Kennedy-esque way of speaking, ask this or that. And since then, well, like some other Massachusettsans, like Ted Kennedy, he's mellowed into a more neutral speech, whereas George W., he doesn't really have a strong Texas accent. His wife has more of a Texas accent, but he's got a very down-home, talking, ordinary way of speaking and thinking.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Next, we talk with a caller in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much. all the eloquent characterizations you've given about the presence and the speeches they give, and whether it was before TV or after TV, reminds me of some of the early things attributed to Lincoln, you know, having traveled from Springfield to accept the presidential nomination and so forth. When he appeared this gawky, lanky, unshaven, bedraggled type of person after that long trip, to the people that was in the presidency, they said, "What kind of a person is this?" You know, regarding him with great disdain and so forth. But after about 10 minutes of talking with them, they were all enthralled. And these personal qualities of Lincoln and other people, say Franklin Delano Roosevelt, really reached the people. And I'm sure that they did most of their own writing to a great extent. Whereas today, speech writers practically are supplying the words right down to the last item, except perhaps Reagan, as you just mentioned. And today we find a deficit in some of our representatives who simply can't speak for what they really represent and intend to, and actually express it and say it so that we can really know the true person that's coming through, rather than some $600 an hour speechwriter or team, you know. I know that editing today is so in demand, so that they don't overstep their bounds as they probably would in an emotional moment. But I can also think back to the time when, like Lincoln, not being so photogenic compared to a Schwarzenegger or Ronald Reagan, or this polished actor, they all appeared so statuesque in terms of appearances that. If we truly had a wise person who could come forth, who may not be this Hollywood or TV image type personality, you just wonder how they would come across with their insight and wisdom compared to the appearances screening that we cast upon the candidate, you know. But I think President Roosevelt certainly came forth in terms of the speeches on the fireside chats, and others have attempted to extend that. I know, I just wonder what you think about this whole matter of relying so much on photogenic and prepared speech writers rather than really hearing the person.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I'm looking at a little ruler here that has portraits of all the presidents. I'm not sure that photogenic is a quality that automatically makes one the most likely person to become a president, just as I've discovered that being a good speaker is also not one of the requirements, or even being the better speaker of two speakers is more likely to make you president. It seems to be other qualities. But as for one of the interesting things about Lincoln, it's true that he was very gawky and unprepossessing, but he also was born in a log cabin. And in the 19th century, starting with Andrew Jackson, it suddenly became very useful to the presidential candidates to have been born in a log cabin, to the point where some of them kind of made their origins more humble than they actually were. So, and yet, in the 19th century, even the humblest of them, people not just Lincoln, but Andrew Jackson and Andrew Johnson, who were certainly not great who came from very humble backgrounds, made a point of becoming very dignified and formal in their presidential utterances.
Yeah, that is interesting, and that's a point that you make in the book Presidential Voices, that Andrew Jackson, on his way up, he worked at it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And at the same time, when we have people who, you know, Bill Clinton comes to mind here, he was always willing, ready, and able to take us back to Hope, Arkansas.
Yes, and Bill Clinton is an example of one who everybody agrees he's a very fluent, glib, gifted speaker. His problem isn't his speaking. It's more the content of what he has to say. He sometimes seems like a used car salesman or someone who says, well, it all depends on what the meaning of is. And he's extremely sincere, extremely, I'd say, even charismatic, but it doesn't get the votes necessarily. Or, well, actually, it did get the votes, but doesn't get everybody's vote.
Hmm. We've got to wrap up here, but we quickly before we go, thoughts on how the Internet might change presidential voices?
Well, when Howard Dean was the leading Democratic candidate back in January, it seemed as if maybe the Internet was going to circumvent the television and even the print media as the way that candidates would communicate with people and win. And then Howard Dean dropped out. So I'd say the Internet has a role to play. Whether that role has anything to do with presidential utterances, either speaking or writing, or whether it has a major role, remains to be seen. Maybe the 22nd century will take care of that.
Yeah, it's a young medium, isn't it?
Very young.
Yeah. Alan Metcalf, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
I've enjoyed it.
Alan Metcalf is a professor of English at McMurray College and executive secretary of the American Dialect Society. His newest book is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
You bet, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures mostly lower. That is the weathermen started taking that cold weather out of the forecast for next week, bringing warmer weather in along with the hurricanes that are clipping along the southern edge of the United States into Florida and maybe into Alabama and Georgia. Wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade finished the day like this, with the September futures down 6.25 cents. They had a high today of 317.75, a low at 308.5, and a settlement price there at 311.25. They were down 6.25 once again. December futures, 329, the high, the low at 319.75. Dease wheat settled 322.5, 7.75 lower. And the March contract was off 8 cents today, had a high of 339, a low at 330.5, settled at 333.25. May wheat for the day, 343, the high, the low at 336, settled at 337, down 7.5 cents. And July futures, 341.5, the high, the low at 337, settled 338.75. They were off 7.75. September corn, 231 with high, the low at 226.5, settlement price at 227.75, down 5.75. And December futures, 239.5 high, low at 235.5. Dease corn settled 236.25. They were off 6.5 cents at the end of this Thursday afternoon. March corn now 247.75, the high, the low 243.75, settled 244.5, 6.5 lower. And the May 253.75 high, low at 250, settled 250.25, down 6.25. July futures 258, the high, the low 254.5. Settlement there at 255, down 5.75. September for next year, 259.5, the high, the low at 256.5. Settlement price for the September 2005 corn contract, 257, down 4.5 cents for the day. September oats now, 148, the high, low at 142.5, settled 144.5. They were off 2 cents. December's 2.75 lower, 154.5, the high for the day. Traded down to 150 and settled at 150.5 for the Dease oats, 2.75 lower. From the soy complex, the nearby beans traded the Septembers at 632 for the high, the low at 623, settled 627.75, 8.75 lower. November, 633 the high, the low at 622.5. Nove settled 628.75 for your harvest month, down 8.5 cents. And the January futures, 639.5 high, low at 630. Settled 635.75, down 8.5. March soybean 646, the high, the low at 637. Settled 642.25, 7.5 lower. And the May soybeans down 6 cents for the day. 646, the high, the low at 637. And the May settled at 642. Once again, they were 6 lower at the end of the day. July futures in the bean pit, 647.5 high, low at 640. Settled 644.5, down 6.5. September bean meal, 180.20, the high, the low at 177.30. Settled 177.70. They were off 340 at the end of the day. And the October 179, the high, low in settlement price, both at 176. That was down 390 for the October bean oil, or rather bean meal. Now the bean oil. September contract, 26.58, the high, the low at 26. Settled 26.57. They were off 13. And the October contract, 26.30, the high, the low at 25.69. October bean oil settled 26.20, off 3 for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today across the board at the Merc for livestock prices. September feeder cattle, 110.70, the high, 109.25, the low, 109.62.5, the settlement, that down 52.5. October 107.75, the high, 106.40, the low, 106.70, the settlement, that down 30. November feeder cattle, 107 even, the high, 105.70, the low. The settlement, 106.07 and a half, that down a quarter. October live cattle, 83.90, the high, 82.50, the low, 82.77 and a half, the settlement, that down 30 cents. December live cattle, 86.90, the high, 85.60, the low. The settlement, 86.27 and a half, down 12 and a half. October lean hog, 66.70, the high, 65.20, the low, 65.32 and a half, the settlement, that down 147 and a half. December, 64.02 and a half, the high, 63 even, the low, 63.25, the settlement, that down 112 and a half. February lean hog, 63.17 and a half, the high, 62.12 and a half, the low, 62.45, the settlement, that down 95. April, 62.30, the high, 61.45, the low, 61.65, the settlement, that down 55 cents. February pork bellies, 95.80, the high, 94.77 and a half, the low, 95.02 and a half, the final price, that down 12 and a half. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 69 points at 10,238. The NASDAQ up 15 at 1866. The S&P 500 8 higher at 1114.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Hunt Tro from Troy, New York writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I'm a dog, so how can I be writing you this question? By the way, why do I hate you so much?"
Funny, dogs usually like me. Even those unfortunate animals who find their way into my laboratory end up thinking of me as master. But then I do have a commanding presence and enjoy giving orders. I once taught a dog to write, and he ended up penning an introduction to calculus that's still used in some land-grant mining and engineering colleges. I imagine your animosities only avail for the true affection you feel for me. Try visualizing yourself as Nipper, the dog in the RCA logo, listening worshipfully to my voice coming out of the Victrola horn.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champaign; Prairie Boat Works, Champaign; and Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning in Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs.